Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, Nectar and Club Card face a probe by the competition watchdog. Greedflation, loyalty card prices, self-service checkouts. Who'd be a shopper nowadays? We're getting a new online fraud charter as the government promises to make big tech do their bit in protecting us. But will it make any difference? Also today, we pay tribute to an American investing legend and the Labour Chancellor who steered Britain through the chaos of the global credit crunch, who both died over the last week. And we reveal the UK's 30 house price hotspots of 2023. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, Tesco's Club Card and Sainsbury's Nectar prices are to be scrutinised by the UK's competition watchdog in a probe into supermarket loyalty schemes. Now, the move comes alongside the Competition and Markets Authority revealing separately that it had found evidence of profiteering by big name brands during the inflationary surge of the last 2 years, dubbed greedflation. And while we're at it, Lee is having a go at the supermarkets as well, getting his supermarket gripes out on the table and holding his own Christmas boycott. Did you like that, Lee? Boycott. Did you get it?
Very good. Thanks.
Thanks. Took me ages to think of that. We'll get to you in a second, Lee. Oh, Simon, Lee, I remember many, many years ago. I mean, this podcast is in, when is it? 10th year next year? A decade of getting my wallet out, tipping it upside down, and the clatter of loyalty cards. Nowadays, I'm a bit more modern. I've got a couple of them on my mobile phone. You were very cynical and had none. Has your position changed in all of those years? Because loyalty cards have shifted somewhat, I've noticed, Simon, over recent years, to the point where actually, if you go into some supermarkets and you don't have it, you're almost tempted to walk out. Because it's going to cost you a heck of a lot more. Simon, what's wrong with loyalty cards?
Those people listening to the podcast cannot see the angry look coming across my face as I prepare myself to talk about this scenario. And the fact that despite repeatedly saying on this podcast, life is too short for loyalty cards.
That's true.
I have capitulated and I have a Nectar card. Now, the way this sorry state of affairs came about is due to the rise of the twin evils of grocery shopping at the moment, Club Card prices and Nectar prices. And this is something that the CMA said this week that it's going to probe. The way these schemes work, for those people who live under a rock or don't shop at Sainsbury's or Tesco, is that there are two prices. No more getting some points and then using them either to get a bit off your grocery bill or some vouchers for the things that you usually buy or multiplying them up to get a bit of money off your Eurotunnel ticket. No. Now, there are two prices. The price for the normal person and the price for the Club Card member. And then Sainsbury's got in on the act with two prices, the price for the normal person and the price for the Nectar prices member. And unfortunately, these prices are on a number of things that would be considered almost staples, foods, or things that you would actually want to buy. It's quite difficult to avoid. And the price gap is really quite horrendous on a number of things. And the way that I finally snapped and got my Nectar card was that I went to Sainsbury's the Sunday before last, and I went in there to quickly buy some stuff for a Sunday roast. Fancied roast pork with crackling. I was going to do some fennel and onion sausage meat stuffing in there.
Very nice, Simon. Very nice.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Hot heat to begin with. Get that crackling up. Then slow and low for a long time. And then get that crackling off at the end. Crackle that up separately. Carve it up. The sausage meat stuffing inside really gives it a lovely sort of tender flavor. And that fennel, onion and sage in there really brings it out. Cold kind of winter's evening. But I was presented with a problem. Mm. The joints of pork all had two prices on them. There was the price for the outsiders like me And there was the price for the Nectar Price members, who got about 30 or 40% off the price of the joints of pork. The price gap was humongous. We're not talking 50p off here. I think there was a £4 difference. And the pork was not fungible. I could not trade it for another thing. There was no other pork option in there that I could buy to do the roast pork. So I was like, right, I'm going to have to sign up for this bleeding Nectar card. Really, it's just like that thing that just tips you over. Unfortunately, the Sainsbury's in the town where I live has no mobile reception in the shop. So I had to go stand by the door. And I was in a hurry. And I was not only in a hurry, I was also running late. And I was meant to be somewhere else. So I downloaded the thing. It didn't even work properly. So I just ended up paying full price for the pork anyway.
Oh, no.
I know. And then to make things even worse, later that week, I thought, I'm going to end up in this situation again. What am I going to do? Am I going to stand firm and just pay more money than I have to for things? Or am I going to finish this process that I started and had to abandon and properly sign up to this next card? And listener, I'm sorry to say.
You know what happens.
You're listening to a man who now has a Nectar card on his phone to get Nectar prices. And I'm sorry. I'm very sorry that I've had to do this. But I'm very pleased that the CMA is investigating this, because I saw someone say earlier this week, and also I read Mr. Boyce's column, which is very good on this, but that this has gone beyond, you know, special prices and vouchers. And this has become something that is really quite punitive for people who don't have the cards. And so I can definitely understand why the Competition Watchdog is looking into this. And there are other shops in on it, is doing it nowhere near as badly as Tesco and Sainsbury's.
Thank you very much for that, Simon. Lovely story. Sorry you didn't get the pork on discount in the end, but you got your Nectar card. Do you know what annoys me about all of this, though, Lee, is Simon says it's one price for sort of members and it's a discount price. It's not. It's a normal price, it seems. Now, I wonder, is it just the normal price for, you know, club card holders? Everyone else has to pay a bumped up price. You're not getting a discount at all. It's just a normal shop. They're making it prohibitive to not have a card. But what ultimately, what's the end game of that? We're going to stay loyal to this company? Where is loyalty cards heading? It used to be about loyalty. Now I don't understand what they're doing.
They shouldn't be called loyalty cards. They're not. They've made me completely the opposite. They've driven me away from these shops. I can't bear it. What is this all about? I understand it from a point of view of Tesco and Sainsbury's have both been able to sign up, I am sure, millions of more people onto its loyalty schemes because of this. Because if, frankly, you go into a shop and you could be ending up spending, you know, if it's just something small, a few quid extra, but if it's a whole shop, it's a massive amount of money more to not have a loyalty card. I think it's absolutely disgraceful. Actually, someone pointed out to me on Twitter this week, and Simon could have maybe done this in his Sainsbury's pork debacle. You could have asked someone if they had a Nectar card, and then, you know, behind you in the queue, pay for it.
Yeah.
They scan their Nectar card, and there we go.
It's a risk, though, really, isn't it? You know,
loyalty scheme sharing.
To be honest, I would be terrified to do that, because when you actually pay in my Sainsbury's now, you're trapped because there's a barricade to getting out, and you have to scan your receipt. And I'm half expecting a SWAT team to swoop down on me.
Actually, I should point out here, I did enjoy Simon going full Simon Lawson there. Talking about his pork, it made me, listeners will be forgiven
for thinking this is a different kind of podcast.
I'm a member of both Club Card and Nectar, because there's no way of escaping it, and I'm not paying more for not having the card, but I am doing so through gritted teeth, and I'm also doing so not out of loyalty, not out of I'm collecting points and this is going to make me stay with you guys. The reason why I've signed up is because our local Aldi has been shut down for refurbishment. Haven't been able to use it. So I've been ducking more into the Tesco Express up the road, and we have a major Sainsbury's up the road as well. And if you don't have these cards, unfortunately, you are, you know, I'm not going to pay needlessly more. But the trade-off is that they want your personal information. You know, that's what they're not, mm-hmm. they're not doing out of the goodness of their hearts. And I think CMA probe is much needed. And the argument is, you know, with all these price fluctuations, it's very difficult for a shopper to work out what the actual price point is. And, you know, I just think that it's not on. Lots of people listen to this go, oh, you know, it's fine. I've always had a club card and next club. But I just don't think it's good. But this week, actually yesterday, I can rejoice because Audi has reopened the local one to me in Wickford.
Yay.
After a good 7 or 8 months. So I'll be going down there and doing my shopping in there and ditching these loyalty cards again.
Get your loyalty card and you flick it in the shop of...
Exactly. And like Simon, like sometimes I go into the Tesco, I can't get signal or it logs me out of the club card. Then I can't remember my password. Then I can't get signal again. And it just drives me around the bend. I went in with my five-year-old a little while back and she was just coming around the shop. I just needed to pick up a couple of bits. And she wanted a yogurt out of the fridge. And the yogurt was 60p club card. It's like one of those pouch yogurts. So it's not just like a pot of yogurt. They're quite pricey. Or it was 95p if you didn't have a club card. Well, I didn't have my phone with me. So I'm sort of standing there having to explain to her how I wasn't going to buy the yogurt out of principle because it was 35p more because I didn't have a loyalty. She took it fine. You know, usually it's going to be a kind of like a barrage of like, oh, I want it. She's like, oh, okay then. But yeah, I don't know in what way, shape or form either Tesco or Sainsbury's or any of these supermarkets think this is a way to keep you loyal. I don't know, maybe I just speak for myself. Yeah. Drive me around the bend and I can't wait to just not be shopping in there again.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with you. It just annoys me. But also separately, greedflation, Simon. Greedflation. Anything with inflation at the end of it, it's bad, isn't it? So what's been uncovered here?
Okay, we've been reporting on this for some time, actually. And all credit to our colleagues on the Mail on Sunday, who are actually well ahead of the curve on this one and produced some great stories that we've run on This Is Money. There's also been a bit of a row between the supermarkets and the brand makers. Now, greedflation is the idea that these branded goods companies, so like the big name brand makers, have been pushing up their prices by more than they need to during the inflationary spike. So obviously everybody's costs have gone up. And the big brand name companies have said, you know, the Nestle's, the Heinz's, the Crafts, these people of the world, the Unilever's have said, look, you know, our costs have gone up. We've got to pass them on. But there's a suspicion that they're passing on a bit more in order to make a bit of profit. And actually, this is a common phenomenon that when inflation is higher, it's easier for retailers to make a little bit of extra money because people don't notice that they're adding a little bit on the top. But it's also much easier for producers to make a little bit of extra money because people don't know that they're adding a bit on the top. And in some cases, they blame the supermarket anyway.
Now, how do we notice? I just want to ask, how do we notice that? Because obviously, you can't deny that costs have gone up. So fair enough that some of it's passed on to consumers. But how do you know that it's too much? I mean, surely that's down to a business model to decide. No?
Well, you just look at the price of something and you go, okay, do my Heinz baked beans need to be 57% more expensive than they were? Or my Hellmann's mayonnaise, does it need to be 42% more expensive? Or my Felix cat food, does that need to be 65% more expensive? Also, the thing that came under fire from the CMA was baby milk formula. As I said on our Lunch Money show the other day, insert your own stealing milk from babies joke here.
Yeah.
Nestle baby milk formula is up 25%. I mean, that looks quite moderate compared to the rest of those price rises that I just listed. But the CMA did single out baby milk formula. But I mean, this even actually at one point, as I said, led to a row between the supermarkets and the brand name producers, with the supermarkets threatening to take some producers' products or some specific products off their shelves because they said that the price of them was being hiked by so much. And the reason why this matters is, of course, that this feeds through into your shopping basket. And the reason why the big brand makers can get away with this is because we have brand loyalty. We stick to stuff. We always buy Heinz ketchup, for example. We always buy Heinz baked beans. We just think they taste better. We don't think that they can be swapped for other things. So they can get away with trying to do it. Now, what's interesting is I think, and we were talking about this in the office the other day, I think with some of these things, it's pushed a little bit too far. And people have now swapped. And the difficulty that you have, if you are one of these brand makers, and they have said in their own results, just to be clear, that they've managed to, they couch it in a slightly different way. They don't say, we've been indulging in greedflation and it's been making us some nice little profits. They say that they, you know, despite cost pressures, we have managed to, and things like that. They say in their results, if you read through some of their results, some of these makers, that, you know, they've been pushing up prices a little bit more than inflation, increasing their revenues and increasing their profits as well. The thing to watch out for is are those profits going up? Because the revenues will go up with inflation, but are the profits going up as well? But I think the problem, to go back to what I was going to say, is that once you swap,
yeah,
you might not go back.
Yeah.
I mean, I must admit, I am a committed Heinz ketchup man. Okay. Always Heinz ketchup. Always got to be Heinz ketchup. Does taste different to the other stuff. But I can't remember why I didn't buy Heinz ketchup. It might be because I think we were having a barbecue or something over summer, and the only, I was in Waitrose, so I was already spending money. It was already spendy. But I don't think that they either had Heinz ketchup, or the only bottle of Heinz ketchup they had was very, very expensive. You know, so they only had the glass bottle or something, and it was crazy expensive. And I was just like, oh, it's a barbecue. I'll just buy the Waitrose one. I've decided I prefer it.
See, there you go.
You know, and that's only a sample of one, which is not statistically significant.
No,
I think other people have those stories to tell as well.
And still Waitrose, you posh boy. I like Stokes, if we're going to go down that route of posh ketchup. Look, I don't want to sound like an apologist, and I'm setting the scene because I know you're going to really go for it shortly, but. If you're going to raising prices is an unappetizing thing to do, excuse the pun, for businesses. So if you're going to do it, isn't it better to slightly overdo it and then you don't have to do it next time? Do you know what I mean? Because prices are going to go up. That's inflation. That's how it works. So, you know, am I being too generous here?
Well, I think the thing that's going on at the moment is that prices have just risen. I mean, you know, you could say the cost of production, the energy, the labor, the ingredients that go into things, you know, things have got more expensive, but, and then you whack it in one go, as you say. But I think when you do that, shoppers notice it more. And it's not just that, Georgie, is it? I mean, the thing is, we're seeing packaging, things getting smaller, you know, shrinkflation. Yeah. That's happening in its droves. And I think that people are just kind of wised up to it. They're a lot more kind of keeping a beady eye on pricing and what's going on. And actually, I've noticed the supermarkets, the big supermarkets, especially in the last 12 to 18 months, there was quite a few rows between the supermarkets and producers, especially the big brands, to the point where I have noticed that mainly in Sainsbury's, they've ditched some of them and have gone really hard on their own brand. So, for example, of that, you know, like those cooking mixes you get for like a chili and casserole and all that kind of stuff. I was after some Coleman's or whatever, or Swartz or one of those. I can't remember which one it is that I like. I think it's Swartz, actually, the chili mix. And I asked someone and they said, oh, no, we've got rid of all of that now. It's all just Sainsbury's brand. So I think there's maybe quite a bit of that going on. The supermarkets are realising that they could produce this and probably make bigger margins themselves rather than having the bigger companies do it. And that someone somewhere has figured out that it's probably more cost beneficial to be going down more the own brand route. And a lot of us now are more used to going own brand and are more likely to try other things, I would argue, because of all this.
That power of the supermarkets must make producers pretty nervous. Look, what can the watchdog actually do? A couple of investigations here into supermarkets, but ultimately, what's the power? What's likely to come out of this?
Well, I guess in terms of the loyalty scheme stuff, is just how the pricing is actually working and how it's structured and whether shoppers are actually getting a fair deal or not, or whether, you know, the fluctuations are just too much. So, you know, you're more likely to buy more of something because it's on, you know, a certain price point, and whether they're actually genuinely good offers or not. And I think that having to, and actually probing what personal information we're giving up and how much we're giving away to, in order to be able to take advantage of these. Now, if there was a kind of personal information free version of the loyalty scheme, maybe it wouldn't be so bad. But I think the CMA needs to be looking at all of that, and also it needs to be looking at you know, these big brands. Not just, you know, I'm not just going to single out supermarkets and say supermarkets are the bad guys. Some of the producers and some of these big names have jacked up prices hugely. And it must be, yeah, as we just said, inflation, prices have gone up for certain things and ways things are made, I'm sure. But to the point where are the prices completely justified? And I don't know. To me, it feels like a real big minefield for the CMA to navigate. I don't know how you kind of hold up the examples and find all that out. It sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah. Well, they've got a lot to get their teeth into, which goes to show what sort of supermarkets are doing. I mean, Lee, look, we've covered greedflation. We've covered loyalty points, but you're still going. I mean, in your article, you also take aim at something else that really gets you about the supermarkets, hence your Christmas boycott.
Yeah, I'm fed up with the self-checkouts, Georgie. I'm absolutely done with them. Look, if it's a couple of items, if I've got a couple of things and there's no queue in a self-checkout, I'll go and use the self-checkout. I'm not a technophobe. I'm not kind of afraid to go and use machines. Mm. Right, that's absolutely fine. But it's when I'm getting, there's two things that have annoyed me about self-checkouts recently. In fact, there's probably more than that. I'll just rattle them off as I go along, right? So I was in a big supermarket. There was like 3-man tills open. This is like first thing on a Sunday. People are just backed up. You know, there's just trolleys going all the way back. And everyone was getting diverted into what I'm calling the payment pen. You know, we're the sheep getting into that payment pen. You know what it's like in that narrow little bit with all the self-checkout machines. And you have to scan all of your own shopping. And look, for a small basket of goods, that's fine. But for like more, like, you know, that red light flashes, you got to get, there's one person manning it all. You have to put your hand up like you're at school. Can you come and help, please, sir? Can't get it to like weigh properly and all that. You know, it just drives me nuts. And I'm sure it causes more queues. You'd be better off just having like small little tills when they used to do the 10 items or under. What's happened to that? You know, that was like...
But Lee, they're not doing it for us, are they? Again, it's like the loyalty things. It's to cut costs so they don't have to have so many staff on tills, surely.
But it's to the detriment of them. You know, I honestly, I'm not childish enough to do this, but I could have just abandoned my trolley. I'd had enough. I'm standing there just like, I can't believe I'm having to wait this long because they won't open any more tills. But where I really, now that's supermarkets. Now where I really draw the line is when I go into a clothing retailer and they've got rid of the tills and it's self-checkout. You want me to take the tags out? You want me to fold up my own clothes and put it in my bag, in a bag? Look, I'm not precious, but at the end of the day, you know, part of paying when you're going to buy clothes, for example, part of that payment for me is having a staff member where you exchange a few pleasantries, you know, nothing out, you know, nothing mad, but kind of like, you know, just nice customer service, basically. Yep. They take the tag out and they fold it up and they put it in a bag for you. Well, recently I went to Matalan and I was queuing up and no tills. No, it is all now self-checkout. And I thought this is a bridge too far. You know, there's one thing lobbing in some bananas and milk into a bag, but there's another thing taking tags out and folding up your clothes. And this elderly gentleman, you know, he's in his 80s or 70s, 80s. He's standing there and he's got absolutely no idea what's going on. And I'm saying to the lady, can't you just open one of these tills? And she's like, these are the tills, like as in the self-checkout. She's like, I can help. It's like, yeah, it's not me that really needs the help. I'm not going back in there. Not if that's how I've got to pay. I just think it's absolutely outrageous. And on that same note, Georgie.
Yeah, you go for it, Lee. Come on.
Carrier bags. I'm fed up. Right. So this came, the carrier bag tax, we're all used to it. 2015, 5p, plastic bag. Get it. You know, plastic bags, they're actually incredibly useful if you use them over and over again for certain things. But completely get it from an environmental point of view, take absolutely centuries to break down. Okay. Understand that. But what's happening now is that most of these retailers have gone to paper bags. Okay.
Oh, Lee, you're a man after my own height.
Paper bags, okay, fine. You know, they could be recycled much more easily, right? And I understand it. Now, they can't really be reused very much. They break, they're useless, they're not really that great. But somehow we are, as shoppers, swallowing now 60p, you know, up to 60p for a paper bag. You know, and I looked on the government website this week and it says retailers don't need to charge for paper bags. So they only have to charge for plastic bags. So why on earth are we just sort of swallowing this and going, look, It's great. Go and reuse your bags. Take your bags in. I fully encourage that, and I do that as much as I can. But there's always times when you get caught short, or you're in a you are in a big supermarket. Your car's miles away. You've got to left the bags in the car. You know, I'm not going to go and leave my trolley there. Go run to the car, get all the bags, and come back again. I'm going to have to just buy some more bags. But paper bags, Georgie, 60p a pop. I don't know what to say. The shopping experience has just become absolutely annoying as anything, and I'm just drawing a line.
Lee, I've got to join you on this one. For both of those. One is I don't normally go to fast fashion stores, but I went to H&M just to buy a little sparkly top. It only cost about 21 quid. It was in central London. Don't often go into central London. Didn't realise when you go to a self-checkout, you have to take off the tags. Sorry, it's not my expertise. Then had to take it home and realised, you know, living miles away, I have to go back into London to get the blooming thing off. Of course, I've already thrown the receipt away because I was like, oh, it's only 20 quid. If I don't like it, it's fine. I'll just give it away. So that's really annoying. Had to go back. To be fair, they trusted me. That was nice because I could have just taken it off the shelf, couldn't I? The other one is the paper bag thing. Oh, my. It drives me mad. Boots. Sorry. I mean, they don't charge 60p, but they were like, oh, it goes to charity. Well, look, if I want to give some money to charity, I do give money to charity. Let me choose the charity I want to give it to. But it takes energy to create these bags. The whole idea of a bag for life is you keep reusing it. And if you've got a decent jute bag or a good plastic, your proper plastic bag, fair play, right? Because you can keep coming back and using it. The paper bags, what energy is being used to create these paper bags, which you can use just once? You're never going to use those things again. It just goes straight into recycle. It's a complete waste of time and effort and money.
Let's find out. I'm gonna message Boots. I'm gonna ask them how much they raised for charity from the paper bags in the
last. Sure, we can Google it, can't we?
And where it went. But yeah, I can't believe I'm on a podcast at the end of 2023 and we're getting really sort of het up about paper bags. But I'm here for it.
Well, I can use
a reusable, but a genuinely reusable bag. My favourite ones come from Decathlon. My wife mocked me as being my favourite shop, but they're little blue bags. They're not canvas. They're, you know, whatever material they are, but they'll fold into themselves, quite small. Mm. You can carry loads of stuff for them. Very sturdy. You can fit a whole shop in them. Absolutely great. I'd like to see more of those on sale at checkouts for a reasonable price. And then I would gladly forgo all those plastic bags or paper bags.
Decathlon's another experience in itself. You throw it into this sort of bucket, don't you? And then it's like, how does that work? Oh my God, am I stealing this stuff? Lee, in answer to your question, I haven't got an answer to your question, how much Boots have raised, but in their first year, they raised £130,000, but that was 3 years ago. So they possibly, I mean, they're still raising money for charity. Anyway, we'll find that out next week. Dear listener, I'm sure you are hanging on there, or you can let us know what the answer is if you do know. But we're going to move on because the government is working with 11 of the biggest tech companies in the world to crack down on online fraud. It will see the likes of Amazon, YouTube, and Facebook sign an online fraud charter. They will pledge to take action to protect users against online scams and to block fake ads and fraudulent content affecting users. But will it make any difference? Especially as it's only going to be voluntary. Lee shaking his head there, not convinced. Firstly, how much, Lee, the scam man boys, of a problem is online fraud via the big tech companies? We know that online fraud is a big issue, but I don't want to say facilitated, but I guess you could probably use that word. The role that big tech is playing in making it, I guess, easy for fraudsters.
Oh, it's huge, Georgie. It's real kind of quantity. You know, the amount of volume of scams that are coming from some of these tech firms is absolutely astronomical, and they're completely off the hook for any of it. You know, they're really not sort of put their hands up, admitted that there's problems, and got involved in any way, shape, or form, it feels like, to help combat this. Now, the thing is about this, I kind of read this from the Home Office, this fraud charter, 11 big firms, including Facebook, as you say, and all the, you know, ones that you would expect. But it's voluntary. There's going to be no financial penalty if they don't, you know, adhere to what they're saying they're going to do. It's a step in the right direction, don't get me wrong. And, you know, the measures that are meant to be taken include verifying new advertisers and promptly removing fraudulent content. But I can't believe that that isn't just what they do anyway. I don't get it. You know, surely that big banks say to someone like Facebook Marketplace, where a lot of this fraud is coming from at the moment, there's a real big problem going on, including things like cars and that kind of thing. I can't believe that there's not a team that's cracking down on this harder because of the way that it's besmirching Facebook's reputation, for example. I don't get it at all. So, you know, this should just be common sense and be happening in my mind anyway. Lots of banks have campaigned for tech companies to be doing more. The director of fraud prevention at TSB, Paul Davis, says, you know, we have the charter now, great. But it's all down to the signatories matching the commitment with meaningful action. And that's the thing, isn't it? Is there going to be meaningful action? So it's all well and good. But, you know, I'm very, very sceptical. But more needs to be done. You've heard me say this on the podcast before. You know, banks have responsibility. Of course they do. They have a responsibility to keep your money safe. And if you are a victim to a scam that is completely sophisticated, my viewpoint is an everyday person will fall for it, then refunds should be coming. But it's getting to the point now where there's such an avalanche of online scams and fraud that it's getting hard for banks just to blanket refund all of the time. And, you know, what about someone like Meta and Facebook Marketplace, where lots of this is coming from? They don't have to do anything about it. They just wash their hands. Yeah. You know, there's no money passing through on the platform. So they're completely, you know, devoid of responsibility almost. And I think that there needs to be a long, hard look at how something like that operates and whether it's to the detriment of the public. And as I say, I don't think personally that banks should blanket refund, you know, and they don't. But it's kind of, I kind of sympathize a little bit with the banks because they have been banging the drum for a long time about the tech firm's role in all this. And will this change anything? You know, to me, I've read it and it just feels like a lot of hot air, but we'll see.
Simon, how have they managed to get away with it? And what does meaningful action actually look like?
Meaningful action means actually doing something about this. With these online scams, what's quite interesting, as Lee said, is that the banks are absolutely furious about some of this stuff. And if you talk to people, you know, from inside the banks higher up, they will tell you how annoyed they are at Meta and Facebook Marketplace and the fact that Meta is effectively managing to kind of wash its hands of these scams. I mean, someone told me the other day that what they'd like to see is them forced to refund people in full if they've been proven to, if they've been proven that the scam originated on their site. I mean, you've got investigations.
That would force their hand, wouldn't it?
Yeah, like the one that they said that was the only thing they thought that would actually make them sit up and do anything about it. Investigations like the one that we featured this week that showed how many car adverts on Facebook Marketplace are false. And, you know, some of this stuff is, you've got to say, well, look, people have to just be wary of it. And if you're looking at stuff on Facebook Marketplace, then you just, it's like the old fashioned classifieds, you know, take things with a pinch of salt, be careful with this kind of stuff. But there are scams where people do the same thing again and again and again. And there's a pattern to it. And I've heard some of these stories, you know, of how people will contact people and then the things they'll do to try to scam them. And it's like, if something's happening again and again and again, you would hope that somebody would do something about it, put some kind of warnings up, you know, even like really simple stuff. Like, we campaigned for ages to try to get the banks to do more about people being convinced to transfer money to people, and one of the outcomes of that was the warning that now comes up that says, could you be being scammed before you transfer someone the money? We will never call you up and tell you to move your money to a safe account, kind of things. And that was off the back of people like us pushing for that kind of thing. So, you know, even a kind of warning system needs to be there, but they seem very reluctant to put any friction whatsoever into their systems.
So Lee, it looks like even if we do get this charter, it may not do that much. So I hate to say it, Lee, but it's in our hands, isn't it? As Simon says, to be a bit wary. Other tips that you have for us in all your years of experience in coming across some horrible cases, Lee?
Yeah, I mean, as Simon said, I feel like we have always been quite at the forefront of all this. You know, we launched our Beat the Scammers section a long time ago, mainly just to arm our readers with all the up-to-date information of ever-evolving fraud and scams and there's nasty tricks that people do out there to pull the wool over your eyes. And I guess my biggest piece of advice is just to read as much as possible, not only on This Is Money, but, you know, elsewhere, and just arm yourself with all of as much information as you can about how these scams work. Because quite often the way that things like this work is you get caught in a rushed moment, that kind of thing. But if there's a little light bulb that goes on your head and you go, this doesn't seem quite right, you know, immediately just stop what you're doing, take your time. You know, that is really what I would say. And it's always evolving. It's always scams that just change, like chameleons. You know, they'll get one that works really well for a time, then that doesn't work so well anymore. A good example of that is the Hi Mum Dad scam, where basically people were targeted pretending on WhatsApp and other messaging services that their child was in danger. You know, can you transfer this money over to me? Anything like that is just a kind of simple phone up your child and find out if they are actually in trouble and something's going on. Don't just blindly trust something. Don't trust the internet, even if it appears, because, you know, scammers and forces can make things appear on your phone like they're coming from a legitimate person. That's the thing. That's what trips people up. It comes under a same message thread of you know, a family member or whatnot, sometimes even your bank, and you think, okay, let's just don't click any links. Just take your time is what I would say.
Good advice as always, Lee. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam Nortavitoro for our weekly look at what's been going on the markets. Sam, it's been the last week of November, and November's been a pretty good month, hasn't it?
Yeah, incredible. I mean, this week has been relatively quiet, but as you said, November has been phenomenal. Most markets this week have been flat, but for the month, the S&P 500 was up 8.9%, you know, one of the best we've ever seen. A little bit of FOMO, the market's getting maybe ahead of themselves with the rate cut projections, and of course that early Santa rally have all helped bring some early Christmas cheer to the markets, which we're all happy with, especially after August, September and October. Some news highlights from this week include Tesla's Cybertruck underwhelming the high expectations. The market was also unimpressed by OPEC's latest vague and voluntary cuts. More positive inflation news though from the US and EU, and China was also looking set to provide QE style support to the property sector. Of course, China this year really underperforming, but overall a relatively quiet week following Thanksgiving, Black Friday and Cyber Monday.
And what do we have to look forward to next week?
Well, the first full week of December, and it is obviously worth saying that seasonality wise it's one of the best months of the year, but with a nearly record-breaking November, upside might be limited. Highlights from that next week include policy decisions on Tuesday and Wednesday from the RBA and the Bank of Canada, plus global PMIs on the Tuesday, which will give us a good overview of the general health of the economy. To the back end of the week, we've got a two-day summit, EU and China, plus the latest US jobs report, which is probably the highlight of the week. It is all but priced in that the Fed are going to keep rates on hold for their meeting in two Wednesdays' time, but this report could maybe influence their meetings next year and when they might start to look to cut rates.
Okay, well, I will speak to you this time next week when we will discover if Santa has continued to deliver or whether we're still waiting for him.
Fingers crossed.
Thanks, Sam. Goodbye.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. This week, we said goodbye to Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's backseat driver who died at the age of 99, and former Labour Chancellor Alistair Darling, who steered Britain through the global credit crunch and Scottish Indy Ref, also sadly passed away at just 70 years old. Let's talk, shall we, first about Charlie Munger, Simon. Warren Buffett, the far more famous of the duo, but who was Charlie?
Charlie is the other half of what have been dubbed the Lennon and McCartney of investing. But he wasn't quite as high profile as either Lennon or McCartney, to be honest. I think Warren Buffett manages to roll Lennon and McCartney into one. But Charlie Munger was a legend in the investing world, and he died aged 99, still working, you know, which is amazing, really. And he worked with Warren Buffett for more than four decades, but he knew him for I think about 60 years. And the story is that they were introduced, you know, many, many years ago, and by a mutual acquaintance who said to Warren Buffett, you should meet Charlie. He's, you know, he's a smart guy. He's interested in business, investing, and things like that. And Charlie was actually originally a lawyer. And the two of them used to share ideas for investing and stocks and things like that. And then eventually they teamed up and went about turning Berkshire Hathaway, which is Warren Buffett's investment vehicle, from a sort of failing textile maker into a spectacularly successful investment empire. But what Charlie Munger is credited with is changing Warren Buffett's investment style. Warren Buffett is described as a value investor. And Warren Buffett's mentor was a guy called Ben Graham. Ben Graham's considered the grandfather of value investing. And he famously wrote a book called The Intelligent Investor. And one of Ben Graham's arguments was that one of the things you can do to try to be successful as an investor is to go out and buy companies when they are really, really cheap. And the idea was that if you buy companies when they are really, really cheap, some of them, when they're priced to go bust, will go bust, but others will recover. And the money that you make from the ones that recover will massively outstrip the losses that you make from the ones that never make it. The most that you can lose when you're buying shares is the price of the shares that you have paid, but the upside is infinite. You know, they can grow and they can grow and they can grow and they can grow. And this was famously described as walking around picking up cigar butts in front of a steamroller. So you're picking up the dog ends as this steamroller is coming towards them, and some of them will turn out to be worth holding on to. But what Charlie Munger did was convinced Warren Buffett to, instead of going for those extreme value opportunities, to try and look for good businesses instead. So instead of going for mediocre companies that had a puff of smoke left on them, could be bought for very cheap prices, to go about buying wonderful businesses at fair prices. So this is a quote from Charlie Munger: forget what you know about buying fair businesses at wonderful prices, i.e. businesses that are just okay, but they're really cheap. Instead, buy wonderful businesses at fair prices. Now, these are businesses that have got some form of moat. That's another Buffett investing idea, something that stops them having competitors that can easily try and steal their lunch, that have a robust finances, so they're not loaded up with debt. There's debt is the thing that often sinks companies, but that have been struck by misfortune. Maybe that's bad management at the time. Maybe it's just, you know, bad sentiment. Maybe it's something that's happened in the world that they have no control over. And if you can buy those at a cheap price, their price will eventually go up. Now, we've got two examples that this has happened to recently. Now, whether you would say these are wonderful businesses, I don't know. But there are two very big name FTSE 100 companies that have seen their share price go up massively from trading at a very, very cheap point during the pandemic. And the examples I would give you there are BP. Okay, at one point, BP shares ducked below £2, which was very, very low for them. And investors who bought on the basis that, you know, whatever people said about the pandemic, at some point, the global economy was going to recover, the oil price was going to recover, BP shares were going to go up, have been richly rewarded. The other one is Rolls-Royce. Rolls-Royce shares, again, when the pandemic hit, Rolls-Royce is very much dependent on the amount of air miles flown by planes, the amount of hours that planes are in the air. And Rolls-Royce was priced incredibly cheaply. Again, if you look at some of the airlines as well, for example, EasyJet, you know, EasyJet shares had absolutely tanked to an incredibly low level, and they've done pretty well recently. So anybody who bought them when they were cheap has done pretty well. Now, whether these count as wonderful businesses, again, I said, you know, that's not necessarily the case. But this sort of change in the way of thinking led to Buffett and Charlie Munger and Berkshire Hathaway holding the kind of companies that can just keep making money, making money, making money. And they have delivered an astonishing return to their investors, an average annual gain of 20% a year from 1965 through to 2022. That's roughly twice the return of the S&P 500. That is a serious gain they've delivered. And they have invested, you know, they now invest into, they hold big stakes in like some very big companies, like Apple, for example. They hold a stake in that. Famously, you know, Buffett used to buy consumer brands, but Buffett has also done another very, very clever thing, which I think Charlie Munger deserves quite a lot of credit for. Because Warren Buffett, whilst being talked about as the world's most famous investor, is not just an investor. Warren Buffett is a very, very clever businessman who, due to his very, very deep pockets and strong financial firepower, can negotiate the kind of deals that you or I cannot negotiate when we open up our investment account and decide to buy some shares. So he has famously, on a number of occasions, negotiated fantastic deals with companies that are really, really struggling in order to put some money in and then been richly rewarded off the back of it. And to finish up on Charlie Munger, here's a few quotes from him, his wit and wisdom. Capitalism without failure is like religion without hell. I don't think you can trust bankers to control themselves. They're like heroin addicts. We have three baskets in investing. Yes, no, and too tough. And then finally, I think one that is quite suitable for the modern age. No man is fit to hold office who isn't perfectly willing to leave it at any time.
Quite. Well, there you go. That was Charlie Munger. 99. Don't want to say it, but I will. It's good innings. My granddad died at 99. What is not a good innings is 70. Sad to hear the former Labour Chancellor, Alistair Darling, who steered Britain through the global credit crunch and the Scottish independence referendum. Lee, I was a bit surprised to read that, where I was out here in Dubai for COP. I wasn't aware he was unwell. 70, tell us about Alistair Darling.
Yeah, so I mean, he was an MP that was elected in 1987. And of course, for us, he's most known for being the Chancellor during the financial crisis, probably one of the worst times to be picked as Chancellor in 2007 when Gordon Brown became Prime Minister. He is a bit of a rarity in politics, it seems, in the way that he's very well regarded by both all political parties. He sounded like a very popular figure within the walls of Parliament. And he steered Britain through what was a global financial crisis, in which he kind of warned during that time, much to the annoyance of Gordon Brown, I seem to remember, about just how hard this was going to be before it all sort of unfolded, and it was going to be one of the worst financial crises on record. He helped with the multi-billion pound bailout of Bank of Scotland, Lloyds, HBOS. Really tricky times. We had the
what a job
we had. We had all the Icelandic banks collapsing, lots of saver money on the hook, and went ahead and guaranteed the savers that were in those schemes were protected. And he was Chancellor between 2007 and 2010, so he was the last Labour Chancellor, because obviously Tories have been in power since then. Very, very sad, obviously, along with Mr. Munger as well. We were talking about the Autumn Statement, obviously, last week, and how Jeremy Hunt was a safe pair of hands, steady pair of hands. I think Alistair Darling could definitely be described as that, in what could only be described in a time of complete and utter financial meltdown. I mean, honestly, if you wanted to give me a nightmare job and a nightmare scenario, it would be, would you like to be Chancellor in 2007 on the eve of a global financial crisis? I think I'd rather just go and disappear somewhere and not
have secretary in a pandemic.
I mean, you could argue, but I think that he was always kind of, I always thought myself, this is a personal viewpoint, I always kind of thought that he came across very well, and kind of in a crisis like that, you want someone who looks like they're competent and knows what they're talking about and doing. And I feel like Alistair Darling ticked those boxes personally.
Simon, you remember those days, don't you?
I do. Yeah.
Weird times.
The early years of my career as a financial journalist, after I'd switched from just normal journalism into financial journalism, I started at This Is Money as a reporter at the end of 2005. So we had the tail end of the boom years, followed by the almighty credit crunch and financial crisis. And it's easy to forget quite how astonishing that period of time was. And it's been slightly overshadowed by the once in a lifetime event that arrived twice in a lifetime, or it wasn't, they're not the same once in a lifetime event, but the pandemic afterwards, which was also completely nuts. But the financial crisis, we would go into work in the morning and they'd be like, is Barclays going to go bust today? Do you think HBOS is going to go bust today? What about RBS? Will RBS go bust? I mean, that's amazing to think that. And Alistair Darling was involved in that emergency rescue of RBS. And he said, what was in my mind is that if people thought the biggest bank in the world had failed, which was what RBS was at the time, there would not be a bank in the Western world that would be safe. And the consequences of that would be astonishing. You know, Alistair Darling said, people forget just how close we came to a complete collapse. And the thing about a collapse of the banks is that it wouldn't just have been the banks in ruins. It would have been complete economic and therefore social collapse. People without money can do nothing. You can't buy your petrol. You can't buy your food, anything. And, you know, that is astonishing. And he was given this incredibly difficult job. As Lee said, I always thought that Alistair Darling struck me as competent, you know, a safe pair of hands. And he joked that that would be his epithet, a safe pair of hands. And he was actually a counterpoint to Gordon Brown, who was known as the clunking fist and prone to fits of anger and rage. And the two of them did eventually fall out because Gordon Brown was keen to spend their way out of the crisis. And Alistair Darling didn't want to spend their way out of the crisis. Alistair Darling is responsible for a number of things that are still hanging over us, though, which I wouldn't say are particularly good. One of them is the removal of the personal allowance above £100,000, which was introduced in those days, created a 60% tax rate. And if you want to listen to me moaning about that, go listen to the Autumn Statement podcast from last week. And it's astonishing to think, actually, that Alistair Darling was the last Labour chancellor. And we have had a series of Tory chancellors since 2010, and not a single one of them has done anything about that 60% tax rate. And then also, I believe he was the man responsible for the 45p tax rate as well, brought in there. But, you know, that's maybe not quite so bad. But he was, you know, by all accounts, a good guy. And I think the tributes paid to him from across political lines were very genuine.
You said last week, Simon, that I think it was last week or whenever you were talking about Jeremy Hunt, that it must be the worst thing to be called a safe pair of hands when it comes to being a chancellor. But you know what? I quite like the idea of being a safe pair of hands.
A safe pair of hands in a financial crisis is definitely
a bad way to go. Right, finally, the average house price has fallen by thousands over the past 12 months and is predicted to fall a further 25 grand by the end of 2024, or almost 5%. That's according to the OBR. Soaring mortgage costs are largely to blame, but while homeowners stand to lose out, some pockets across the country have defied the cost pressures and seen property prices increase. So you got an article on your website where the 30 hotspots are. Lee Boyce, where are they?
Just before I say wade into this, it's a real kind of like mixed bag at the moment of house price indexes. As we've reached December, we have nationwide house prices out today, suggesting that house prices are up for another month. But on a seasonally adjusted basis, they're not up. And they're down 2% annually, which is all just quite a confusing mixed message for readers and listeners going, what? I think
you know how much I love house price statistics.
Oh, I do. I mean, I know that you're kind of probably got all of this printed out and you're going through an Excel spreadsheet of a postcode across Britain of what's going on. But I mean, it's one of those things where there's always winners, there's always losers. And actually, I think what this piece of research shows that you can't just say this year house prices are down. It depends where you live. It's very much pockets of the country in which are bucking the trend. And East Lothian is the top of the house price charts over the last 12 months, according to the research that we have got here, which is of Office for National Statistics data and by estate agents Hamptons International, and suggesting that actually in East Lothian, prices are up 10.3% in the last year. I mean, that's 30 grand. That's a massive increase. You know, you have to go into these localized markets to see what's going on. Is there a strong jobs market? Has it got strong transport links to other job markets? That kind of thing. But there's lots of areas in here, not just up in Scotland. It's real when you look at it on a map, it's almost like London and the southeast is excluded from it. And there's a few pockets around sort of like the southwest, but a lot of it is concentrated to the Midlands. That's where a lot of the house price rises seem to be coming from. So for example, third place is Rutland, which is I think Britain's smallest county. They're up almost 28 grand, 7.6%. Nottingham is one of the bigger places in here. They're up 6.7%, so 12 grand. I'm not going to read them all out, but you can go and have a look. There's 30 areas that are listed in here that are up by 5.4% or more. I mean, that completely flies in the face of what you would say is logic this year of people. If you ask someone on the street what's happened to house prices this year, I think the majority of people would say they've fallen back slightly, which, again, would just be a different answer depending where you are in the country. And we've also got the biggest fallers in here. Now, Kensington is number one, tiny violin time. But I always think Kensington quite often either is top of this list or bottom of this list because it's on so few transactions and it gets a bit complicated. But a 10% fall in Kensington, so just the casual £148,000 wiped off a house price.
Yeah. Wow.
But I'm telling you, George, it's one of those things. It doesn't represent what Britain is. You know, our offices are in Kensington. You know, some of those homes around there are worth £50 million plus. It's not a very kind of like good way to look at the market. And actually, the other place that always features on this list and is the second biggest dropper of the year is Aberdeen. And that always features on this
list. Oh, yeah.
6.1%. It's got a very kind of sort of job market there that's linked heavily to oil industry, mm-hmm. and it gets a bit of a clouded mixture. And then number three is the Orkney Islands. So, I mean, are there any listeners in the Orkney Islands? Please let us know what's going on in the property market because we'd love to hear from you. If someone's listening to this in the Orkney Islands, I'd absolutely love it. So I think the real conclusion of this house price sort of data that we've got here is that don't just blindly think that house prices are falling. Yes, the OBR are saying that house prices are going to potentially fall 25 grand next year. Will they? Who knows? Were we given similar predictions at the end of last year? Quite possibly. Were we told that house prices are going to keep falling? They're going to fall massively. I mean, if you take nationwide information from today saying that annually house prices are down 2%, I mean, for me, that if they were going up 2% or they're falling 2%, that's kind of just a flat market to me. That's not a kind of plummet. It's not a soaring market. It's just a kind of market that's in a mixed bag, depending where you are in the country.
I'm still waiting for the 18% that George Osborne promised if everybody voted Brexit. Isn't that what you said?
I'm sure it was
bigger than 18. I thought 18 was quite... Either way, it's definitely not gone down 18% since the vote. Simon, your views on this? Any surprises in there?
Any surprises in there? Not so sure. It's very difficult, isn't it? And even within those local areas, you'll have some pockets of places that are going down, some pockets of places that are going up. You know, the best streets will always hold their value, that kind of thing. But if people have overpaid for a house on the best street, then they might find that a year later they can't sell it for the same amount. And literally the problem is that basically people can't pay the same amount for homes at the moment that they could 2 years ago because mortgage rates are much higher and most people need a mortgage in order to buy a home. But I'll finish with a quick maths question for you, Georgie, because I know you love house price reports.
Yeah, big fan.
If Nationwide Building Society in its house price report says that the average price of a house in October 2023 was £259,423. And in November, it was £258,557. So the average price of a home has gone down by £866 over the last month. How much percentage-wise have house prices fallen by?
Don't care. 0.4.
They haven't. They've gone up 0.2%.
I don't care.
Magic of seasonal adjustment. House prices have seen their third monthly rise in a row, but only due to seasonal adjustment. A statistical quirk means that an £866 decline in the average house price means they've actually gone up by 0.2%. And that's the magic of house price reports for you.
It's like when the Chancellor goes, we've got some fiscal headroom. Based on what? Based on I say so. Right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, or indeed anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can tweet us at thisismoney. You can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, join in the debate in reader comments and find all podcast past. And you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. And Lee Boyce would specifically like to know if we've featured in your Spotify rap for the year.
Yeah.
So apparently podcasts come into this, and we want to know, did the This Is Money podcast end up in yours? And also, what did it end up alongside? And there will be points awarded if you send in an email telling us that you featured in the This Is Money featured, sorry, in your Spotify rap, and there was something really interesting or odd alongside it. So if you've only been listening to Mariah Carey and This Is Money this year, we want to hear from you.
Yeah, I do. You can tag us in some social media of some sort. I'm not sure, but I'm sure you can. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.